You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Jim Goldston with the Open Society Justice Initiative, and we have with us today Dr. Catherine Sickink, who as of January will be a professor of human rights policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and who has authored a book and a number of publications now, which we'll be talking about on the theme of the justice cascade, and Cesar Rodriguez Garavito, who's professor of law and founding director of the Program on Global Justice and Human Rights at Los Andes University in Colombia, who has written a great deal about the inter-American system and these issues in that context. So we're very pleased to have both of them today. Catherine, Dr. Sickink is going to start with a brief presentation of some of her work and findings, and then Professor Rodriguez is going to then offer a commentary on that, and then we'd love to open this up for an interactive discussion amongst all of us here. I should just note briefly by way of introduction that the issues that are discussed in the Justice Cascade are of central importance and great interest to many at Open Society Foundations. The battle against impunity, the search for accountability for grave crimes is something we've been working on, and many people here have been working on for a long time. One of the extraordinary things that Professor Sickink's research has done is to provide actual facts, data, with which to address one of the most contentious questions that has arisen about the tension between peace and justice, and what is the impact of prosecutions of perpetrators of grave crimes. So it's wonderful that this research exists and is being advanced, and very much looking forward to hearing more about that. So, Professor.
Well, thank you first. Thanks for hosting the session. And the Justice Initiative is doing such important work that I really see this as an opportunity for me to share some of my work with you and to get your feedback and comments on it. And it's always a great pleasure to share any session with Cesar, from whom I always learn something new. And it's also great to have some of the people here in the audience, people from our Budapest seminar last summer, like Christine and Chris, and also to have Aria here. So anyway, thank you. As you know, 2 years ago, I published a book, The Justice Cascade. I want to very briefly, for those of you who may not be familiar, because I didn't expect people to necessarily have read the article that they sent out that summarizes. So very briefly, I'm going to summarize a few findings. But mainly, I want to present to you some new research that we've done since the book came out. In particular, the National Science Foundation has provided two separate grants for my team. It's a team between the University of Minnesota and Oxford for us to compile new and better data. And basically, we are going, in just the next few days, our website will go up with the data from the first National Science Foundation grant, which is on domestic human rights prosecutions, amnesty laws, and truth commissions in the world. And then the second grant we're now 1 year into. We're also coding reparations policies, vetting and lustration, customary forms of justice, and civil trials for damages. So we already have, and we will have, what I think is the most comprehensive database in the world about the use of transitional justice. Now, you may ask, why compile all this data? But I think, as Jim suggested, and as you all know, there's some very contentious issues out there in the transitional justice field. These debates have gone by names like truth versus justice, restorative justice versus retributive justice, peace versus justice, international justice versus domestic justice, etc. And we felt that the best way we could help was to bring some empirical data to bear on these debates, and so to say, if we look at these debates using data from the world, what kinds of answers can we get about these debates? I say we because as you know from the piece you read, but also I have these great co-authors So Kerry Booth Walling, Hun Joon Kim, Jeff Dancy, just some of my co-authors who have really helped me do this research. The new data, some of which I present here, helps answer a couple of critiques that were made of the book, The Justice Cascade. One critique that was made was that we did analysis about the process of prosecution, but we didn't have data about verdicts, and especially about guilty verdicts. So some people said, you are really overcounting the number of prosecutions because you're looking at the whole process of prosecution from indictment to preventive detention to extradition requests. And in the end, most of those aren't going anywhere. So the new data, as you'll see, has the number of transitional countries in when we get, actually get trial verdicts and guilty verdicts, the green line guilty verdicts. And then another critique that people made was, well, yeah, you're counting prosecutions, but you're not looking at amnesty laws. And there's simultaneous processes that's underway. There's an increase in accountability, and with all these amnesty laws, there's an increase in impunity, and they're essentially canceling one another out. So as you see, we have the red line are new amnesty laws that are being adopted. And so what's interesting, of course, is that there's a dramatic decline in new amnesty laws. Existing amnesty laws continue to be on the book around the world and still having an impact. So I'm not saying amnesties are gone. I'm just saying there has been a decline in new amnesty laws. As I said, the striking thing is we are finding that many of these prosecutions we've been tracking do result in verdicts and do result in guilty verdicts. The single most important finding that came out in terms of the impact of transitional justice that came in the book and that has since been sustained by the new data and new analysis we've done of the new data is that the use of domestic human rights prosecutions is associated with improvements in reports of physical integrity abuses. Now, this may sound, to this room, may sound kind of commonsensical or even simple-minded, but as you know, there's a lot of people who have made the argument, including Jack Snyder, who's just up the street here at Columbia University, that the use of prosecutions makes things worse. It makes human rights violations worse. It leads to conflict. It undermines democracy. So there are people who are making that argument, and just to sustain, as we have, using new and better data and using complex analysis, that holding constant everything we know that we can measure that leads to human rights violations, we still find that human rights prosecutions have an independent and statistically significant impact on improving basic physical integrity rights. Many of you want to know why I have confidence in this conclusion, and I think Jim suggested you might want to know what kind of data we're using to measure physical integrity abuses. And so we are using two scales, which we did not create. They're the scales most used by social scientists, the so-called political terror scale and the Siri physical integrity index. And those, both of them, are coded from two sources, the Amnesty International annual reports and the State Department country reports of human rights practices. And they're coding four physical integrity violations: summary execution, disappearance, torture, and political imprisonment. Okay, so when I say it's associated with improvements, I mean associated improvements with those four types of physical integrity abuses. Now, there are some problems with those measures. I've just published a report, an article in Human Rights Quarterly with Anne Marie Clark critiquing those measures. Okay, and I'm happy to talk about that. But what I can say is, to the degree the measures have a problem, the problem they have is that we know so much more today than about human rights violations around the world than we knew in 1980 when those measures started to be crafted. Okay, that the biggest problems the measures have is that sometimes they make it seem that nothing has improved in the world. Okay, and it looks like torture is flat in the world, and we don't know whether there's actually as much torture today as there used to be, or that we know so much more. The human rights movement has been so good at information politics, at gathering, disseminating information, that it's just we know much more about torture. So the problem the measures have is that sometimes they make the world seem worse than it may be. So when you have a finding like our finding, which is that human rights prosecutions are associated with improvements, you're actually is a finding against the bias in the data. And so I have more confidence in this finding because I actually know that we're sort of fighting against a bias in the data to show that things don't never get better. So let me just explain briefly. The findings are not that using a human rights prosecution in 1 year immediately leads to improvements. Rather, it's that there's a cumulative effect of the use of prosecutions over time that's associated with improvements. Now, it doesn't mean that this is the only thing that leads to human rights improvements. In fact, we know from our research, and we control for these factors, that war, both internal and international, democracy, levels of economic development, and levels of inequality are all very much associated with violations or improvements of human rights. Okay? And in our analysis, those factors appear as important. But those are all, big term structural factors that are hard to improve in the short term. And so the advantage of prosecutions is that they are actual policy tools that governments have at their disposal that they can use and that we show can have an impact. Often people say, well, prosecutions are so expensive. And the question is, expensive compared to what? Expensive compared to military invasion? Expensive compared to policies that could really raise the GNP of a country. So I think those are the other factors that can also contribute to improved human rights. And human rights prosecutions may not be expensive compared to those other factors that we know can lead to human rights improvements. I can tell you now of all the other transitional justice mechanisms we're looking at, there's no other mechanism that appears to have the kind of big impact that criminal prosecutions have. And we are seeing really interesting findings. Like with truth commissions, we're seeing a finding that high-quality truth commissions are associated with improvements, but not any old truth commission. High-quality, do they have public hearings? Do they produce a report? Do they have archives? Okay. But as far as we know so far, and again, we haven't done all the data collection or analysis, there's no other single transitional mechanism that has this kind of effect. That doesn't mean that these can't be used very productively together. Now, notice I'm not talking about the effect on satisfaction of victims. It's very that requires a whole different methodology, not what I'm using here. It requires, surveys or in-depth interviews with human rights victims. And it's very likely if we were doing that, we would find other things. We would find that reparations are the most important, or maybe customary forms of justice in some countries. So I'm saying for the measures we're using, and that is those physical integrity right measures, we're seeing association with improvements. Now, the topic we chose to focus on today is the interaction of international and foreign human rights prosecutions and domestic prosecutions, especially in Latin America. And let me just show you, one of the big findings of the book, the original book, is that the great bulk of prosecutions are domestic prosecutions. And there's so much attention and so much controversy is focused on these international tribunals, and it misses the big picture. The big picture is most of the actions happening in domestic courts. But the international and the foreign prosecutions are really important backup systems. So I'm arguing there's a decentralized, interactive system of accountability in which the domestic and the international and foreign complement one another, not international or domestic, but how they work together. There's very interesting regional, the bulk, over half of these prosecutions are in the Americas, which goes to the topic for today. The question is why? We know it's not that there were more human rights violations in the Americas than elsewhere, and that the Americas were innovators. These are the first 10 countries in the database that use human rights prosecutions. You see after Greece and Portugal, it's a list of 8 Latin American countries with the date of their first prosecution. And so when we look, however, at the international prosecutions, we find this interesting factor, and this is kind of what first led to the topic for today. Someone looked at this thing and said, look, when we look at international prosecutions, we find that they're roughly divided between Europe, Africa, and Asia, and it's zero for the Americas. There is no international, as you know, no international or hybrid tribunal for the Americas. You know, we can talk more about this, but this is, you know, basically the ICTY is holding up those European numbers. It's the ICC and the ICTR, the Sierra Leone Tribunal for Africa. And very interestingly, there's a lot of prosecutions in East Timor. This is one of my big kind of questions. What was going on in East Timor? And so that's why such big Asian numbers here. But the Americas, despite the absence of international prosecutions, there have not been an absence of concern with using external pressures to bring to bear on domestic prosecutions. And the Inter-American Court and American Commission have been very important. Seso is going to talk about that, so I'll just leave that to him. But I'm going to talk to you briefly about foreign human rights prosecutions by region. Our foreign human rights prosecution, this is a prosecution in a domestic court of another country where the human rights violation didn't occur. Okay, so. And this data is not good yet. Okay, so I'm presenting preliminary data that's incomplete. So I just want to, we have 79 foreign prosecutions here. And I think it's just, this is the hardest prosecution data to gather. There's no central data source on it. There's no website. And so you just have to go one by one and try to dig them up. We've got a lot of expertise on Latin America in my team. And it could be we're just picking up a lot of Latin America because Latin American human rights organizations may publicize it more. But right now, as you see, we've got 90% of foreign prosecutions involve a human rights violation that occurred in Latin America.
I think that's quite wrong.
You think that's wrong?
I think that there have been European organizations pressing universal jurisdiction, like FIDH in France. And I don't know, for example, if you're picking up the French prosecutions that they have gotten. You'd have a hard time doing it unless you went organization by organization to see what they've actually pushed by way of universal jurisdiction. So in France, you've had, let's say, a number of Tunisian prosecutions. You probably wouldn't find that unless you had a detailed examination of.
I think you're right. This is not, but I suspect even the more we get, we're going to see this very strong role for Latin America. So this is the other part of it. This is the location of the court where the trials occurred. So there, so a lot of trials that we're picking up so far, and I think you're absolutely right. It's not a complete.
What's happened in Europe, of course, is that they allow prosecutions in absentia. And so you have trials where you don't have the defendant present, and then actually apprehending the defendant gets to be the major issue.
Exactly. So the one thing I want to point out here that's quite interesting to me is while most of these are happening in Europe, the second biggest categories are happening in Latin America. So you're starting to get the situation where there's a trial of a Chilean in Argentina, for a Chilean human rights violation in Argentina, or a Uruguayan violation in Chile. Okay, but just so you know, so this is the breakdown. If you want to see it, the country of the human rights harm, and the court, the count of prosecution events. And what we see here is at least the data we have so far. It's three countries: it's Chile, Argentina, and Guatemala. Which is very interesting. And so the question is, why so much? And then if you look at where it's occurring. It's three countries again. It's, we know Spain. That's something we all knew. We know Italy. That Aria just said, they do trials in absentia. But the second point is that there are many, many Argentine victims who had dual citizenship. Italy let Argentine citizens hang on to dual citizenship 3-4 generations away from immigration, and they could still get access to the Italian courts. And so the large number of Italy. And what the surprise for me here when I first saw this was France, and it could be what you say about the Federation, being involved, very involved. But the France is, I thought Belgium would be more important than it is because of the universal jurisdiction laws and some African trials that have been allowed to move ahead. So this is what we have so far. And I don't think it's complete, but I think it raises some issues about Latin America. And I just want to just end briefly with those issues. And that is, why have foreign prosecutors been so important for Latin America? And it's partly that most of these countries did have amnesty laws. Domestic prosecutions were closed down for quite a while, amnesty laws. Innovative human rights organizations in Latin America, mainly representing victims, looked for all sorts of ways to get around the amnesty laws. And one way they searched out were these foreign prosecutions. And so many of these cases were brought forward by human rights organizations based in the Americas, sometimes based in France or elsewhere, on behalf of Latin American victims who wanted to search for accountability abroad because they couldn't get it at home because of their amnesty laws.
Just one other comment on this. Uh-huh. For instance, in the UK, two of the prosecutions in the UK involved immigrants from Belarus to the UK who were prosecuted there for Nazi war crimes committed during World War II. That is, they had lied on their immigration applications. That became the basis for the UK initially to pursue them, and then they prosecuted them for the crimes committed during World War II. So World War II legacy crimes are, in fact, a significant part of the European use of universal jurisdiction.
Right. And we have vacillated. Normally, our database has excluded the successor trials from World War II because the database starts in 1980 because of the sources we're using.
Some of those were right. Much later than that.
Right. But I'm saying we have generally excluded the Justice Cascade is about sort of what happened after the successor trials for World War II. We're saying there was unique circumstances surrounding Nuremberg, Tokyo, and the successor trials for World War II. But the Justice Cascade is something that is builds on Nuremberg, but is a different phenomenon. I just wanted to say, so what's interesting in Latin America, so there has been very extensive use of these foreign prosecutions. It's done mainly on behalf of victims by human rights organizations. They get standing in different ways, not only through universal jurisdiction. They get standing, as in the Italian case, through dual citizenship. They get standing because the crime was partially committed on foreign soil. As you know, the Condor situation in the Southern Cone, there were all sorts of crimes that someone was kidnapped in Argentina and brought to Uruguay, etc. They get jurisdiction, as you know, in the Spanish case, because sometimes you have Spanish victims, the Spanish priests in El Salvador, for example. A small number are universal jurisdiction cases. But I think the main thing is that these foreign prosecutions are not necessarily all universal jurisdiction cases, but a much more interesting mix of ways in which the courts get standing. The main purpose of these foreign prosecutions was basically to pry open space for accountability back home. And so the Pinochet ruling, I think, was paradigmatic in that way. You had a ruling that Pinochet could stand trial in Spain, but he was allowed to go back, and eventually that did open up space for domestic prosecutions back home that Pinochet was facing when he died. And, you know, hundreds of prosecutions opened up at that same moment for Chileans to deal with in their domestic courts. And so this is why we just in end I would say I think it's a flawed notion to think about the international or the domestic or foreign prosecutions or domestic prosecutions, and really the importance of really understanding this interactive system by which you can use these international angles in order to put pressure and open space to pursue justice closer to home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Fascinating. Cesar, we're going to turn it over to you right now. I just want to flag a question either for yourself or for the discussion to follow. Mm-hmm. And Catherine, you alluded to this. Are we talking about a global justice cascade, or are we talking about a justice cascade in Latin America? You mentioned the factors which many people would look to explain, well, of course, Latin America has historically specific circumstances and reasons that would explain why there has been stronger impetus for accountability than elsewhere. It had, many countries had a tradition of democratic government. The rule of law was stronger historically in a number of those countries than elsewhere in the world. Levels of economic development perhaps were higher. There were stronger levels of civil society. There were a number of factors that might explain why this would happen. So, which I think goes to the question of how significant and widespread a phenomenon this is, that I, at least for those of us engaged in some of this work, are particularly interested in hearing what you guys have to say about this. The other question when it comes to Latin America, which I think Cesar is going to touch on, is the role of the Inter-American system and in reinforcing these efforts, and as well the dynamic between national governments and the Inter-American system, particularly where in the last 3 years we have seen the Inter-American Commission come under significant pressure from national governments, including some national governments who have been pretty good on accountability, but who apparently haven't seen the Inter-American system as necessarily serving their interests. So curious how that works. Cesar, please.
That's cheating. That's a really complex question. Okay, I'd be happy to comment on that briefly. But really, it's a pleasure to be here and an honor always to be with Catherine teaching or giving a talk. Really, well, as I told Jim and the phone call we had, she's the expert in this field. I've never written on transitional justice. We have this running joke at the Justicia, which is the organization that I co-direct that has been supported by OSF for since the beginning. And so this is, we're grateful grantees of the OSF, so it's a way to give back a little bit to OSF. We always have this running joke that Rodrigo, the co-director, is in charge of repression. I'm in charge of emancipation, right? So he's the one dealing with all these issues of torture, disappearances, and all that, and I have I tend to specialize on issues having to do with socioeconomic rights, with environmental justice. But of course, being based in Colombia, you have your sort of instant expert on transitional justice, especially these days. And I'm, what I'm going to do is in 5 minutes, I'm going to raise three questions, and I'm going to say something really briefly about the Inter-American human rights system. The first issue is, well, as you may know, Colombia is going through a process of negotiation with FARC, which is the oldest guerrilla group in the world, and for the first time in a long time, there are, you know, good prospects of reaching an agreement with FARC. Far from being a sure thing, but we're getting as close as we have for 30 years now to reaching an agreement with FARC, between the government and FARC. Colombia went through a similar process with the right-wing paramilitary squads 5 years ago, a very limited transitional justice process, but that led to the demobilization of some of the major right-wing paramilitary groups, mostly in the northern part of Colombia. So really the question here is kind of an unfair set of comments for Catherine, but I'd love to hear her reaction, because she very clearly states, both in the book and in the paper, that they use empirical comparisons, which is, I was trained as a lawyer and as a social scientist, so wearing my sociologist hat, that's the kind of comparison that I also prefer, because it gives you a point of reference, not in the ideal world or in a counterfactual world, but actually in the real world. So you're comparing transitional countries that have used prosecutions with transitional justice that have not used prosecutions, right? And on the basis of that, you try to answer this really complex and urgent question on whether or not, for instance, prosecutions make civil wars continue for longer or create more human rights violations, right? Now, the issue in contexts like the Colombian one is whether prosecutions or the threat of prosecutions thwart negotiations and an agreement altogether, right? And there's no way for the data set to answer that question, I think. But this is the first question. Is there anything in the data set that helps us answer the pressing question, for example, in Colombia that we're facing now in the human rights community, about the extent to which we should press for prosecutions, say, for the top FARC leaders, or even for the rank and file, in a way that does not create an insurmountable obstacle for a peace agreement. So the old dilemma between peace and justice, right? The second question has to do with the very last paragraph in your review article, which is really puzzling and interesting, right? And you say, well, this is a new avenue for research, the combination, the interaction effect between amnesty and prosecutions, right? Because your colleague Lee Payne and others have found that maybe the combination of amnesty and prosecution through time, right? Maybe having amnesty law first and then having groups persevere through time, trying to get the human rights violators convicted either in domestic or international courts. That's sort of what gets you to the best case scenario. Now, what we're going through in Colombia might be an interesting, it's a unique case in many ways, but the most likely scenario would be one in which the combination of amnesty and prosecution is embodied in a single piece of legislation, meaning that the government and Congress have passed a law whereby courts would prosecute the top leaders of FARC and then maybe offer alternative punishment, maybe home, I don't know how you call that, residence, house arrest, exactly, as opposed to actual jail, and then extend a blanket amnesty to everyone else. Right, so I was also wondering whether there is anything in the data set that could tell us something about the potential impact of this kind of combination, not through time, but in a single piece of legislation. And finally, I'll say something about the Inter-American Human Rights System, which, by the way, this effort that OSF has supported, it was key, it continues to be key support for a coalition of organizations working in defense of the Inter-American human rights system. As you may know, it came as after, under really heavy attack from many states, from Ecuador, Venezuela, to Colombia, Brazil. And one of the things that some states resent is precisely the activism of the Inter-American Human Rights Court, for instance, in cases in Peru. Peru also was very aggressive against the commission and the commission just recently. But, you know, there's a paper that I mentioned to Jim and Catherine by Alexandra Hunes at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that argues that really there's sort of an additional layer of criminal prosecution going on in Latin America, because you do have these foreign prosecutions and also domestic prosecutions, but the Inter-American human rights system has played a role in sort of getting states to prosecute some human rights violators who were not prosecuted domestically, right? Of course, that's not criminal jurisdiction. The level of compliance with these orders is always limited, but it has had some effect. So again, to raise a final question is whether you see this as an additional piece of information that would you have to add to your data set, or whether it's a completely different world in which this is human rights jurisdiction that would, in the end, entail domestic prosecutions that you would see in your database.
Thank you, Cesar. That's great. Catherine, maybe you want to take on board those initial questions, and also if you care to address the question of the regionally specific nature of this phenomenon or not, that would be great. And just if I can add to that, because I just noted in your article, you talked about the crucial role played by small groups of public interest lawyers, jurists, and activists who pioneered this field. That also makes me wonder to what extent this is regionally specific, or at least system specific, because certain legal systems are more open to the prompting, prodding, participation of private actors, of victims, to actually bring cases forward than others. Certainly civil law systems, I think, in Latin America are more open to that kind of participation than many common law systems are. So I'm wondering as well how that affects the dynamic.
Well, what great questions. Terrific questions. And so we briefly start on the Latin America question that Jim kind of started with. And I would just say, so if I go back, to the truth is I'm giving you an old chart here. This one is actually old. You see, I was using the 2009 data, and we now have some 2011 data. I just didn't have a chance to get the new chart made. But the new chart has America's 48, percent. So what is happening slowly is that the percentage of Latin America in the database is decreasing. And one of the, Lee Payne and I did a chapter for a book called Transitional Justice in the Asia Pacific. And the first draft of that paper is we said, well, there's really not much going on in the Asia Pacific. And then we started getting the new data, and we had to totally rewrite the chapter and say, you know, a lot more is going on in the Asia Pacific than we originally thought. And so what I would say is this is definitely a trend that's being initially driven by the Americas. The Americas have had a very important protagonist role here, but it is not limited to the Americas, and it is very much diffusing elsewhere in the world. And so I think we have to think of it that way, a trend where there's been huge Latin American protagonism, but it's not a Latin American justice cascade. It is, in fact, a global justice cascade with very imperfect and varied relevance in other parts of the world. So as you see, the Middle East, North Africa is always tiny. And I used to say, when I get to talk, I say, of course, with the Arab Spring, that's going to change, and maybe. And then, of course, we see, no, it's not changing. And again, that's going to be my question to you folks. You've got your hands on the pulse of what's going on maybe around the world more, and maybe what you, I don't know what you're seeing. So the second point of Cesar's point about these empirical comparisons, and the big issue in Colombia is whether the threat of prosecutions can thwart peace negotiations. That's the $100 question, isn't it? This is a question that Jack Snyder has always put to me. And he always uses the threat of prosecutions. Mm-hmm. And one thing I say, in terms of empirical comparison, the first thing I say is, how am I going to measure the threat of prosecutions? Every time it's in a newspaper op-ed piece, every call that an NGO makes for prosecution. So one big issue is if the threat of prosecutions have an effect, I need to know what constitutes a threat. And so it's very hard to measure. It's very hard to measure and test whether a threat of prosecutions does anything. So all I can do is whether prosecutions themselves have a negative effect on peace. And the best new research is one of my fabulous students. He was in the photo there. Jeff Dancy has just finished a dissertation where he has a whole chapter asking this question using all of our data and using conflict data that goes down, not just civil war, but goes down to as small as 25 battle deaths in conflict, 25 deaths in conflict. And what he finds is this, that actual prosecutions in the immediate or short term can temporarily worsen dyadic conflict between two groups. But in the long term, that is more than, I believe, 2 years, 2 to 3 years, prosecutions are associated with no conflict recurrence. Okay? So prosecutions have a long-term effect to help end conflict. But they can have a short-term blip, especially in dyads. And the reason, and we go dyads, but in Africa today, as you know, there's so many insurgent groups that you have to just look at war, you have to look at dyadic war between two different, between the government and each individual insurgent group, right? So that's the best I can say. Okay. And I can ask him to send you that chapter because it's really interesting. The last paragraph on amnesties and prosecutions. This is the biggest debate within my team. Okay, so Lee Payne and I are in the same team, and she's got a book out that says the only combination that works is amnesties and trials together. And I kept saying, Lee, there's something wrong with that because amnesties are supposed to stop trials. And if you've got amnesties and trials together, it means that amnesties aren't working. So I'm going to assume it's trials that are doing the work, not the amnesty. And she would say, you're not even measuring amnesties. You can't even talk about it. And so we measure amnesties. We're running the new analysis. And we have a very preliminary paper just presented in the American Political Science Association meetings. And I think what we're finding is that blanket amnesties do not help. Okay, blanket amnesties don't help. But the combination of a partial amnesty and trials may be that combination that's associated with improvements. By partial amnesties, we generally mean amnesties that are considered that are fit under international law, that is, exempt war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, et cetera. So like the Guatemalan amnesty, you know, where these major crimes are exempted from the amnesty. But we have only 6 examples of partial amnesties in our database. They're all the recent ones. All the recent amnesties are partial amnesties. We aren't seeing new blanket amnesties for the most part. And so it looks like the answer is no, it isn't just that you should combine amnesties and trials, and that's a good option, but the combination of a partial amnesty and a trial may be associated with improvements. And the question is, why would that be? And it could be because it calms certain groups, certain spoilers out there who might be wanting to have a coup. And so the amnesty, they made sort of calm these spoilers long enough for democracy to take root. You know, I never have understood the Colombian legislation well enough where it's embodying. My understanding is it's not just a single legislation, it's for a single group.
Yeah.
And
well, it's not, when the decision doesn't say it's not geared towards the FARC only, but, you know, this process is going on. So,
right.
Yeah, so we'll see.
And so I guess I want to just turn the question back to you. What do you think when you embody amnesties and prosecutions in a single piece of legislation?
That's the position I'm taking, I'm putting my organization's hat. That's the position that we're defending, that you need a combination of those two. Not extend blanket amnesties for any kind of crimes, of course, because you can no longer do that under international law, and you have the ICC writing letters to the Constitutional Court 2 days before their ruling on the constitutionality of the very controversial on the constitutionality of that piece of legislation, but there is no way that the Colombian criminal system will be able to prosecute 8,000 foot soldiers of FARC for every type of crime, and that's the position also of the Attorney General's office. So it's from a normative point of view and from a pragmatic point of view, that's the position that we've defended at the Justicia with a number of other human rights organizations. But there are differences in conceptions of transitional justice, even within the human rights movement, and some national and international organizations are pushing for a more sort of punitive approach to the negotiations with the FARC.
And then the other question I have for you then is, so because people always say this to me, right, is that, but we know, over time, amnesties have been challenged all over the world, and amnesties are eroding and being derogated, as you know, or being annulled, especially in Argentina and Uruguay. So when you make an amnesty, you may not be able to promise that the amnesty is going to hold. So what position does the Justicia take on that?
Well, there's a way to take a responsible position there, because you cannot promise anything on behalf of the international tribunals. The Inter-American Human Rights Commission, for example, has just written a critical report of that piece of legislation under Chapter 4 of the annual report, and that's a big concern, for instance, for the FARC. They say, well, even if you, Santos government, promise me that I will not get prosecuted, well, I don't know what's going to happen. The government says, well, all I can do is go to the UN, as Santos did a month ago, and say, we need your understanding. And we need you, the international community, to understand that we need to bring to a close a 40-year, 50-year civil war, right? But it's a problem that's impossible to solve domestically. I mean, this is where your two-level dynamic interaction model of transnational governance is so helpful, but it's no longer possible for a national government to promise that that the international committee will not prosecute the FARC. So that's it's a bind.
It can't promise. Right? Yes.
Can't promise.
So should we open it up now a little bit?
I see Arya's already got a question.
No, I want to give you another example from a different part of the world in which a combination of a partial amnesty and prosecutions actually turned out to be very effective. That's Sierra Leone. What happened in Sierra Leone was Cody Sanko, the leader of the RUF, a particularly brutal guerrilla group that specialized in chopping off hands and arms, signed a peace agreement and insisted on an amnesty as the basis for signing the peace agreement. And then the United Nations also had to sign on. And Kofi Annan instructed the UN representative to add a provision saying that this did not apply to international crimes, such as genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And so that became the basis for establishing the special court for Sierra Leone. And that court has been among the more successful international courts, including the criminal conviction of Charles Taylor and the 50-year sentence imposed upon Charles Taylor. So it was a partial amnesty, but it exempted those crimes. And I think that was effective both in settling the war in Sierra Leone and in allowing accountability for the most egregious crimes that took place.
I mean, in terms of evaluating the impact of amnesties, mm-hmm. it's not a static phenomenon, right? And you yourself have said your data show that blanket amnesties were once a phenomenon and they are less and less so. So doesn't that affect expectations? I mean, it isn't the goal, if one is pursuing accountability, in fact, to reduce and ultimately eliminate the expectation, the reasonable expectation, that you could be accorded immunity for what you've done. And frankly, I think that is what is happening over time. At least there's a good argument for that, right? So although Charles Taylor was purportedly promised X, Y, and Z by President Obasanjo, he couldn't deliver because the pressure for accountability simply was too much. And we're seeing that again and again. So the promise of amnesty, as you say, simply is not credible increasingly over time.
I know the Sierra Leone example, but I actually didn't know it was Kofi Annan himself that advised.
So
that's very interesting.
He instructed the UN representative on that.
And where did Kofi Annan get the idea
Annan,
from?
Kofi Annan didn't start out as a human rights advocate. And then over the course of his tenure as UN Secretary General, became more and more of a human rights advocate and, you know, proposed the UN Human Rights Council to substitute for the UN Human Rights Commission. And then in his post-Secretary General period, in his role in Kenya, also was responsible for pushing trials. He was responsible for asking the International Criminal Court to indict those who were not indicted in Kenya as a result of the commission that looked into the post-electoral violence. So by the time of the Sierra Leone peace accord, he had become this kind of human rights advocate, which he had not been at an earlier phase of his career. You know, you could speculate that it was in part his own guilt feelings about his role with respect to Rwanda. He has been very, you know, outspoken about his own errors with respect to Rwanda.
Because I knew that was a turning point. It's really a turning point in the transitional justice world, but it's a more interesting turning point if it comes from the top of the UN system than if it then it's sort of this representative making decision on his own. I wanted to just go back to, so this interesting thing about, so yes, I think one of the things that's at stake here is deterrence, right? In the sense that are people being dissuaded from committing future crimes because they believe they'll be held accountable. And the one piece of data I didn't tell you, but now that we have this information on guilty verdicts, we're able to run the analysis, and what we find is prosecutions themselves are associated with improvements, and prosecutions with guilty verdicts are more associated with improvements. That suggests that there is some part of what's going on, I'm not saying all, but part of what's going on is deterrence, the actual...
Can I suggest some complexities using two other examples, one the Yugoslav tribunal and one involving the creation of the International Criminal Court. One of the interesting things to me about the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia is that during the war in Kosovo, the crimes which had been the subject of prosecutions growing out of the conflicts in Bosnia and Croatia were not repeated in Kosovo. That is, the prosecutions for Bosnia and Croatia involved the camps, they involved the siege of Sarajevo, they involved large-scale massacres like Srebrenica. None of those crimes was repeated in Kosovo. There had been no prosecutions relating to Croatia and Bosnia for mass forced displacement, even though that took place in Bosnia on a huge scale. And yet the crime that was committed by the Serb forces in Kosovo was mass forced displacement. By the time the Kosovo War took place, 1999, the Yugoslav Tribunal had begun to be taken seriously. That is, after Tony Blair was elected and Robin Cook became Foreign Secretary, the British troops in ex-Yugoslavia started making arrests of people who had been indicted by the Yugoslav Tribunal. And that was 1997 that those arrests started taking place. And so 2 years later, one had to take the Yugoslav Tribunal seriously. And in Kosovo, you just didn't, you had different crimes. Probably 10,000 people were killed in Kosovo, but you didn't have the same crimes that had resulted in prosecutions. The other example involves the DRC after the creation of the International Criminal Court. The International Criminal Court, it required 60 countries to ratify the treaty for it to come into existence. And on April 11, 2002, 10 countries ratified. They each wanted to be the 60th. So there were 66 countries. And so the International Criminal Court came into being July 1, 2002. It had no retroactive jurisdiction. It could only prosecute crimes committed after that date. At the moment that it came into existence, there were five other African countries that had troops in the Democratic Republic of the Congo fighting a war among themselves and looting the natural resources of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. One of the 10 countries that ratified on April 11, 2002 is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. They faxed their ratification into the UN and the UN accepted it. Between April 11, 2002 and July 1, 2002, all five other African countries, that is Rwanda, Uganda, Zimbabwe, Namibia, and Angola, all withdrew their troops from the Congo because none of them wanted to be the first to be prosecuted by the International Criminal Court. So there was no actual prosecution, but just the threat that they could be prosecuted effectively ended what was looking like an all-Africa war at that moment. Didn't end it because there were local militias affiliated with the international forces, but it substantially reduced the amount of conflict in the DRC. And so I think one has to look at each of these cases very closely to see how they actually had an impact, changing the nature of the crimes, bringing about a withdrawal of forces. Those kinds of things have to be taken into account as you think about the effects of the possibility of prosecutions.
I completely agree.
Okay, you want to respond briefly?
I completely agree, but what I say is this. As you know, we really need these in-depth case studies. As you know, in-depth case studies on the same case by different people arrive at very different conclusions. And so we have seen as many in-depth case studies of Uganda or DRC saying, see, the ICC involvement has contributed to more war, made things worse. And so what we're trying to do is not say, no, we don't
need... And at different times, it could produce different results.
We totally believe in those kind of in-depth case studies, but we also think it's useful to have this kind of a global study that may be persuasive when the case studies are divided when they talk about impact. Sorry, Jim.
Not at all. That's very helpful. So Allison had a question.
Hi, I work at the Justice Initiative and the International Justice Program. So my question is, to what extent you're kind of interrogating your framework of understanding of human rights. So I'm getting the sense, and from reading your book and your article, it's primarily within the civil and political rights paradigm. And I think actually there's a big overlap in terms of like the causes of human suffering into like more of like economic, social, cultural rights, for example. And we're just starting a project in the Justice Initiative now looking at economic justice, and I think it's important perhaps for expanding your data set to get a bit of sense of like the regional dynamics, like perhaps you get different results for Africa and Asia, like looking at different concepts of human suffering and different concepts of human rights. And I think that's really important because in terms of looking at, I mean, I happen to really love your work in terms of the kind of positive inspiration that we get. It's quite a depressing area of work, and to actually hear somebody say, no, you're having some impact and things are getting better, I think that's very encouraging. But the truth of the matter is that I've worked at like all the different UN criminal tribunals, and I'm not too positive, actually. I just see that the perpetrators and the causes of suffering are actually highly mobile, and they will go where we're not looking. So I think, actually, the identities are remaining the same, but they're just exploiting more vulnerable populations. So we might see improvements in terms of prosecutions within the paradigm that you're seeing up here, but I don't think that's necessarily reflective of the reality. Like, to take a quick example, like you're talking about the Sierra Leone sitting, the main cause of that conflict has never been addressed. So we're looking also on the Justice Initiative at blood diamonds and other like economic reasons for that conflict and how to address them. But those very same actors are now diversifying and moving into like some of those actors were involved in the elections in Zimbabwe, for example, which were able to happen with the appearance of, you know, completely being regular in order, but with a lot of very sophisticated forms of intimidation and human suffering that were inflicted kind of in a more insidious way. So I'm concerned about like a skew in your findings, maybe as a result of the framing of the data set.
Well, one is, I should say I'm first very supportive of a of the kind of approach that you've taken here at the Justice Initiative to have a very broad understanding of what constitutes justice and try to think about the many ways that one can pursue justice in a wide variety of issue areas. So first, let me say I'm very supportive of that. Mm-hmm. And that my choice of choosing in my research relatively narrow. Okay, even though I say it's taken us 6 years to gather the data and hundreds of research assistant hours to do it, so it's narrow, but it's extremely time-consuming, is that no one had nailed this topic. Okay, there was still, I mean, Jack Snyder could still run around saying human rights prosecutions make things worse. And I'd say, no, Jack, actually they don't, and not be believed, you know. And so I found that, no, I want to take a narrow and focused topic, and I want to see if we can really, really make a very persuasive argument about effects, gather the data, do the analysis. Just because I choose to work on a narrow thing does not exclude or does not intend, I don't intend at all to say this is the only important thing. I'm saying I've got, but no one has made the case I'm making, no one has made it until now. Okay, as persuasively as I'm making it. So I thought it was important to take that narrow set and do it. And in particular because I have the political terror scale and the physical integrity index, I have an index that's gone from 1980 to the present that I can use as my dependent variable. Okay, this does not mean that we couldn't choose to look at what kind of effects do these kind of prosecutions have on other things that are concerned to us. We could look at what effect, is there any impact on inequality? We could look at, is there any impact on social and economic well-being? Okay, so just the fact that I choose to work on a narrow topic doesn't imply that the rest of it's not important or that it might not make an impact more broadly. It's just whenever you do research, you have to, you've got to, you know, okay.
No, and, I get that.
and so I just want to be clear that I think that, that these are very important questions you're asking. They're questions that other researchers could use our data to try to answer, okay? And I you know, encourage my students and others, rather than putting this data up online, is to choose other people to use it.
Sure.
One could choose to look at prosecutions. There's new kinds of prosecutions that are around about economic, social, and cultural rights. People are doing prosecutions now on water, on access to basic drugs, HIV and other basic drugs. And so one could sort of use this model and says, what happens when you start getting
sure,
litigation on economic, social, and cultural rights?
I don't mean in terms of litigating for water rights. I mean looking at, for example, ways that economic actions can impact, even within your paradigm of civil and political rights, like forced transfer of populations, for example. A litigation of that type of case would still be addressing the parameters of your research, I think. So there might be more cases out there. But I can certainly, like, and it also relates to the deterrence theory, and there's some writings on that too, which I've I guess you saw the Aster Institute database that was released today.
No, I know.
I've been looking at it.
Here all day.
It's a new database looking at international criminal prosecutions in national city. Okay.
So let's, if we can, I just want to make sure our colleagues in the disembodied ether, which is like Washington, D.C., maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody want to contribute to the discussion with a comment, question?
Hi, this is Angelica from the Latin American program.
Excellent. Hi.
Hi, Angelica.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation and Cesar for your comments. I just was wondering about how do you see the United States in this cascade, especially regarding the ratification of the Rome Statute and especially regarding the issue of universalization of international instruments, especially in the United States and Canada, in the inter-American system.
Can I add to that?
Just before you, before you answer, we've got to, please.
I just wanted to jump in and ask as well. I'm not at OSF, but I'm a fan. Lee Payne was my advisor at Oxford, so thank you for coming. This question is for Cesar to tag on along to that. Is there any sense that, considering the Colombian case with Plan Colombia and all this involvement of the United States in Colombia, that there's any sort of pressure or views coming in from the Department of State on whether or not the FARC is should be prosecuted? I just wanted to get that initial touch base with you.
On the U.S. case, people who've read the Just Cascade may remember I have a whole I have a whole chapter on the U.S. case, the case of the Bush administration torture policy, and what I say is that it's both that you need to look, if you're claiming the norm cascade, you need to look at the impact on powerful states, not just on less powerful states, and that it's a very sobering case. Because it's quite clear that, I mean, as you know, a number of low-level soldiers in this country have been held accountable in court-martials and other administrative proceedings, but there's been no high-level accountability in this country. Not only that, but we have essentially what I would call a de facto amnesty law with the military commission. There's two laws. One that was passed by McCain mainly to try to use the Army Field Manual and end interrogation had added into it essentially an amnesty. So the U.S. case is one that I would say demands an interactive strategy of the kind I've spoken about. In other words, prosecutions are apparently closed in this country. Foreign prosecutions have been attempted in Spain, Italy, France, Germany. They have not succeeded except the Italian case on extraordinary rendition, not on torture per se. I think that the international community would be well advised to move ahead on more foreign prosecutions of U.S. torture cases. It's a clear-cut case. We have ratification of the torture convention. We have implementation of the torture convention in domestic law. And we have violation after the ratification of the torture convention. There's ample, ample evidence for prosecution. And I think that the international community should make this a high priority to figure out how you're going to prosecute U.S. officials in foreign courts and at least deeply complicate travel strategies, if not actually hold anyone accountable. So, but you didn't ask just that question. You asked about ratification of treaties. No one is holding their breath that the United States is going to ratify the Rome Statute in the near or short. I mean, nor apparently any other treaty, since we couldn't even ratify the Disabilities Convention. So no one's holding their breath about treaty ratification. Let me just say, as a political scientist, I always have to say this. No one ever pays attention to it. The ratification rules of different countries are completely different. No other country in the world, except maybe Switzerland, with its referenda, has as difficult ratification rules as the United States. Okay, so it's simply not the same thing to ratify a treaty with a majority vote in a parliamentary system. Most countries of the world ratify with majority votes. Many ratify with majority votes in parliamentary systems. It's not the same thing as ratifying a two-thirds supermajority in a presidential system. So as much as I think we really, really need to get the United States to ratify these treaties, and it's a huge problem that we haven't ratified, you simply can't compare a majority ratification to a two-thirds ratification.
If I can just add briefly on the very important point about trying to stimulate, motivate more accountability in the United States for abuses that took place under the Bush administration or ultimately under this administration as well. There have been, in addition to the national court rulings that you discussed, there was a ruling last year in a case that we brought in the European Court of Human Rights involving the torture and rendition of Khaled al-Masri, a finding against the government of Macedonia, and an explicit finding in that case that the CIA engaged in torture of Mr. al-Masri on the tarmac at the airport in Skopje, Macedonia. There's also been a ruling of the United Nations Committee Against Torture in respect of Sweden's action on two men who were tortured as well in CIA-related rendition. And there are now pending before the European Court several other cases from Poland, Romania, and Lithuania involving alleged CIA torture and rendition in those or from those countries. A hearing is now scheduled in early December on one of those cases. And there have been efforts to try to keep those proceedings secret. And I think it's extremely important that publicity about these efforts be disseminated so that the United States understands that the failure as yet of United States courts to act does not mean that there won't be accountability in other jurisdictions for these actions.
I couldn't agree more strongly. And I do discuss in the book quite in detail the case in Milan, of extraordinary rendition in Milan. And what you find there, everyone goes, well, what's the use? It's in absentia trials. What you find is the individuals prosecuted in Italy have already paid big costs in terms of some. Many have been forced to leave their CIA. Many have been discover, of course, they can't travel anymore. And so there actually are costs that are imposed on individuals. They're not prison, but real world costs. So I very much support this.
I just wanted to say something quickly about sort of the Latin American side of this equation is that it has become a big problem that the U.S. has not ratified, or Canada has not ratified the American Convention, for instance. This is what gives countries like Venezuela and Ecuador rhetorical ammunition to go after the inter-American system. And it's hard to counter. I mean, how can you explain that the commission is based in Washington, D.C., that the U.S. and Canada were rightly quite active in defending the Inter-American system, both in Cochabamba and elsewhere. We're very happy to work with delegates from those two countries. But then, of course, the moral authority is not there, right, because they're not under the jurisdiction of the court. And so it's an easy case for some governments to sell to the friendly media and to some sectors of the citizenry that this is a U.S.-controlled system, right? And we have worked with organizations like ACLU to try to get something moving in the U.S. Congress. But, you know, we know that this is not going to happen in the near future. But it is a big problem. It is a big problem for us in Latin America, for organizations trying to defend the Inter-American system. And then on Colombia and the State Department. The State Department has been incredibly silent about the Colombian negotiation process. And I think for good reasons. And I actually think it's better for them to keep relatively quiet and for other states like Norway and Cuba to be more involved. Those are the two states that are officially part of the negotiating table as sort of as friends of the process, and they played a key role. The EU, and now, of course, because of the deep involvement in Colombia, they would be seen as partisan in this negotiation. The FARC would never accept sort of an interference from the State Department. And on the other hand, the U.S. government was quite vocal in the negotiations with the paramilitary squads. And that was actually a good thing as well, because since they were seeing the U.S. as funding the counter-terrorism, the counter-guerrilla campaign on the part of their state, when they had to say something about the abuses committed by the army and the paramilitary squads in alliance with the Colombian army. So back then they did, and some Congress members also spoke up in support of a harsher treatment for the paramilitary leaders.
I mean, I'm interested to hear, Cesar, your point about the impact, the very debilitating impact of the United States and Canadian refusal to ratify the convention. We see that again and again throughout the world, the impact of the perception and the reality of partial justice, of a rule of law applied only to the powerless or the less powerful, not to the most powerful, is undermining justice institutions like the International Criminal Court again and again. Right. And that's a critical question.
Right. As you know well, as you're well aware, that the huge resistance in Kenya was just recently in Kenya about the involvement of the ICC on the basis that it's become sort of an institution focused only on Africa. That may be unfair, but you know, when you look at the evidence, looking at the data, well, that's the case. And the fact that there are no cases on other parts of the world, including Colombia, well, makes people in Africa uncomfortable. But you know, from the point of view of the Inter-American system, it has become one of the key problems for those of us trying to strengthen as opposed to debilitating the Inter-American Commission and the court.
Any further questions or comments from anyone here or in D.C.? Yeah.
I mean, I think the Colombia example raises some other interesting questions with which to interrogate your research. And one I have is, I mean, there's obviously these human rights prosecutions can take place in a variety of settings. And in the Colombia example, we're talking about the FARC, and it would be a prosecution of people who have opposed the government that's going to stay in place. And that seems very different than human rights prosecutions that come in a period of transition when two sides, you know, there may be players from two sides that are prosecuted, or the victor group was the group that was not in power before. And I'm wondering if human rights prosecutions in these different scenarios have different effects on the physical integrity indicators that you speak about.
So we are right now, our research is about transitional countries, right? The reason we're doing that is because the data for the whole world is, which we did start to gather as well, is complicated because it includes data on formerly democratic countries like Colombia that nevertheless have had very problematic human rights situation. It includes data on a country like the United States, but it also includes data on all these authoritarian countries where it's kind of hard to know if there's a human rights prosecution happening there, whether or not it's a you know, is it a rule of law system? Can we call this a real human rights prosecution? And so we've been hesitant to use our data on the whole world. And so we don't have findings on the whole world, okay? Partly because you're looking at, as at prosecutions in, what, 190 countries, or possibly 190 countries, and you don't know whether all of those are, it's reliable. We could just do it for transitional and democratic countries, and I think that should probably be the next step, and say we can't talk about this prosecutions in authoritarian countries, we don't know whether they're genuine, but let's add the fully democratic countries in and see what difference it makes if we do that. And I think that should probably be the next step, add in the Colombias, to the United States, others, to see whether human rights prosecutions make a difference there as well.
Sean.
You talked about the justice cascade in Latin America potentially having an impact in Asia. And that was around jurists and other international actors. I was wondering if you could say more about the mechanisms by which a justice cascade in Latin America can have a global impact, and like the role of a global organization like the Justice Initiative in facilitating those mechanisms.
So I guess the main thing I meant was that the justice Latin America was very important for in helping initiate the justice cascade for, you know, because of the early adopters I showed here, right? And so the degree to which it's just the cascade is simply an accumulation of many countries. And what difference does that, you know, how does that work globally? So I think that usually it's not a diffusion. It's quite rare that people will say, oh, we're modeling ourselves after Argentina. But rather, the way it's happening is simply that there are many transitional countries in Asia that for various reasons of their own very often demand from civil society organizations, as you know because you work with them, that are asking for accountability. They may occasionally, may be occasionally useful to borrow something from, so there are certain legal, useful legal tools that have been used in Latin America, but also in international courts, the notion that crimes against humanity are not subject to statutes of limitations, for example, has been a very useful legal tool throughout Latin America, the notion that disappearance is a continuing crime and therefore cannot be affected by amnesty laws. As long as there's no body, then, you know, you can't amnesty someone. Those are tools, I think, that could travel to places, because you'll very often find that what's blocking prosecutions elsewhere is the same thing, statute of limitations and amnesty laws. And so there might be innovations from Latin America that would be relevant. But every, every country faces its own issues, too, and often has to devise their own kind of domestic solution. Every legal system is different. You made the point of some civil law systems may have a bit easier time dealing with this than common law systems. And that's something we've never thought about. A lot of us in this country seem to think, well, common law, that's the, you know, that has certain benefits. And what we've found is there's the mainly civil law systems use private prosecution in criminal cases. And we have found elsewhere that the ability to be a private prosecutor in a criminal trial is a huge way that these trials are coming forward. And so we're finding that maybe that's one reason Latin America's been so involved, is because virtually every single one of these countries has, except Uruguay, has provisions for private prosecution in criminal cases. When I first used that word to an English-speaking audience, the lawyer said, there's no such thing as private prosecution in criminal cases. And I said, well, not in the United States. You know, but there's this assumption that the way we do it is the only way. And so this private prosecution is very important in some countries, but as you know, it does not exist in most common law. So much doesn't exist that that is even, just the very notion is unfamiliar. So it's doing this kind of research is super difficult because you have to know about domestic criminal law in hundreds of places, and it's almost impossible. Anyone has tried to study domestic criminal law, even in a couple of countries. I know, you know, even knowing in Guatemala or Argentina or Colombia, it's so hard. And so it's very, there are lessons that travel, and there are other things that are just going to have to be bottom-up innovation. But what we know, for example, in Latin America has been the region with the most challenges to amnesty laws. There's been huge number of challenges to amnesty laws in our database. They're all in Latin America. So there's still a lot, long ways to go to know, what do you do when you get an amnesty law? How do you start trying to figure out a blanket amnesty? How do you start trying to figure out how to work your way around that?
So, on Asia, are you looking at Bangladesh?
We are looking at Bangladesh, yes.
Because that's a case study. That's a huge thing in itself.
There's a question.
Rachel, you're coming in. Last question? Comment?
Could I, yeah? Hi, please. Rachel Neild with the Justice Initiative. I was curious as to whether you'd looked at all at reparations or asset recovery as well, or whether you're thinking about doing that and how you think it might play into this picture.
Yeah. Hi, Rachel. Yes, we right now are gathering data on reparations. Okay? As you know, the UN definition of reparations is basically all transitional justice and more. So to make it manageable, we're looking mainly at compensation, basically, for victims. But we are trying to look at land restitution as well. And so we hope in about a year or so we'll have that reparations data available. We'll be able to add that into the analysis and to share that with people as well. So far, what we're finding with all the new data we're gathering, customary forms of justice, reparations, vetting and lustration, and civil trials, is it's far less widespread than we originally thought. The numbers are just a lot smaller. We're not finding, we're through, we've done reparations in Africa, we found much less than we anticipated. And customary forms of justice, really there's only about 20 countries in the world that are using customary forms of justice. So it's been held up as a solution, but it's not really available to most countries of the world. If you don't have indigenous communities that still retain some kind of customary forms of justice, you don't really have that as an option. And so, so yes, we are gathering that data. Yes, we will make it available. So far, I've been surprised that some of these other forms of transitional justice are not more widespread.
So I just want to say, I mean, I think this discussion, you know, it just underscores how important your work is for what Open Society Foundations is trying to do, what our partners are doing. It legitimizes that work. It forces us to interrogate the assumptions underlying that work. It provides us with data and tools we can use to advance that work. It's really, really important. And I think it's clear to me we want to continue to benefit from your research and dialogue with you as you carry this forward. So I want to thank Catherine and Cesar very, very much. This has been really, really a great session. Thank you.